This is an ABC podcast.
A few weeks ago, I went to see a talk held by the China Matters Forum, and the talk was being given by Jason Yat-sen Lee. Jason is an Australian who's lived and worked in Beijing, and Jason was talking about the troubled China-Australia relationship and what, if anything, we can do to improve it. So, full disclosure, I should say that Jason Yat-sen Lee and I have been good friends for more than 20 years now. But in that speech, Jason revealed all kinds of things about his own family story that I didn't know before. Jason's parents migrated to Australia from Hong Kong, and Jason had the classic migrant childhood in the southwestern suburbs of Sydney, growing up with street cricket, footy cards, and Chico rolls, which is actually a giant Chinese spring roll, but you know what I mean. At the same time, Jason imbibed Australia's democratic values and its multicultural aspirations, which were just starting to grow. Jason got a law degree. He worked at the International Court of Justice in The Hague, in the Netherlands, and he was very active in the Australian Republican movement. During his eight-year stint in China, Jason Lee fell in love with Chinese culture, its language, and history. And so he has some insight into why the relationship between Australia and China has gotten so bad in recent years. And he has some ideas on how we might mend the fence without compromising Australia's core values. Hi, Jace.
Hi, Richard.
When you try to start to grapple with the contradictions of modern China, where do you start?
I think the first place to start is to understand that with any complex being, it's never black and white. It's never simple. So in particular, if you think of something like China with its thousands and thousands of years of history, you know, all of its contradictions, is it rich or poor? Is it modern or is it ancient? Is it a capitalist country or is it a communist country? All of these contradictions are very, very difficult to reconcile if you just have this monolithic view of China. And I struggled with it as well. When I first went there to live, I really struggled with these contradictions. I couldn't make heads or tails of it. And it took a particular framework from a friend, Professor David Kelly, who had a framework that he called the seven personalities of China that I've since bastardized into five personalities that really brought some sort of framework to help me reconcile what China really was.
Take me through these five personalities and what they reveal about China and the various aspects of China's character.
So the starting point, I think, is what Professor Kelly calls the self-sufficient civilization. So that's the civilizational China, the China with 5,000 years of recorded history, the proud culture, once the most powerful, prosperous country on earth, but in modern history has suffered 200 years of terrible humiliation at the hands of the West, has a serious chip on its shoulder, this sort of inferiority / superiority complex. But it's also the China with which so many Chinese Australians and the Chinese diaspora have a deep emotional connection. Next to that, there is the People's Republic of China, which is the political entity, a completely different beast. It's only 70 years old, it was formed in 1949, and it's ruled, as everybody knows, by the Communist Party of China. It tries to claim the entirety of Chineseness as its own, but obviously that's not true. So if you take my personal experience, I associate with the Chinese culture, the language, I regard myself as Chinese civilizationally, but I've got nothing to do with the PRC, with the political entity. I'm an Australian citizen.
It's a bold claim for the Chinese Communist Party to make because it spent so many years trying to break what the old Chinese culture was. It talked about the four or five olds that had to be destroyed and shattered, and Buddhist temples were broken up and old artefacts were destroyed. And has the CCP just tried to forget all of that?
I think it recognises that there is a very powerful sense of belonging that the culture brings with it. You know, the Chinese culture, and not just Chinese culture, there's a number of cultures around the world that have very, very strong roots in language, in familial customs, in a worldview. And those customs and that culture has been consistent for a long time. And it's a very powerful force. And I think the Chinese Communist Party has realized just how powerful that is in terms of offering a sense of belonging and a particular worldview to the diaspora. And it's a way of furthering its particular sort of political aims in trying to unite a universe of Chinese-ness.
So there's the first two. You have the self-sufficient civilization. Then the second is the People's Republic of China, the Communist China. What's the third?
The third, I would call the leader of the developing world. That's one of the contradictions you often see. On the one hand, you have China, this massive investor. Everybody's concerned about Chinese investment and Chinese money, the laying of debt traps, everything being bought up by the Chinese. But yet, China in some forms regards itself as a developing country. And it often bands together or it sticks up for other developing countries and saying, well, we shouldn't be subject to the same climate targets as developed countries because we haven't had the benefit of the decades and decades of economic growth. So China often holds itself out as the leader of a group of developing countries, sticks up for their interests, but in return expects their support in international forums as well.
You're talking about like China's relations with African countries, particularly here.
And Southeast Asia, South America. China will often band together with them in multilateral forums. Then you have China, the investor, the business person, the trader. And this is the China we often see in the newspapers here, you know, buying up Australia's farmland, as some people think. In reality, China owns about 2.5% of all of Australia's agricultural land, and it's ranked 9th in the list of countries that, in terms of ownership of assets in Australia, way behind, about the same level as Belgium, I think.
Right.
But there's a great concern about the Chinese using its financial muscle to buy everything.
Like the panic we see when there are Chinese faces at house auctions as well.
Exactly. And that's another personality of China. China is as the financial juggernaut, the commercial China. And then there is the China that, in a way, we don't hear a lot about in Australia now, and which I think is actually really important. And that is what Professor Kelly calls the herald of the high frontier.
What does that mean?
It's a China that actually does good in the world. It's a China that can be a responsible global citizen. And you see, you know, that China through its leadership in the climate debate, its renewable energy targets, its contribution to the UN peacekeeping budget, its scientific work in Antarctica and in space. It's a China that can and certainly should be encouraged to be a force for good in the world. Unfortunately, I think the debate about China in Australia and in other parts of the world has just become so black and white that we can only see this dark, monolithic China, this almost an irredeemably bad China. And I think that's very, very dangerous because it leaves no space in people's minds for cooperation. It paints China as an enemy that is irredeemable. There's no path back.
In recent years, most of the information we get, or the Chinese presence in our lives, I suppose, in Australia, comes from what the Chinese Communist Party is saying. A couple of years ago, I went on a book tour of China. And so I went to Beijing and Shanghai, and it was wonderful. It was completely wonderful. I've been really mindful ever since then to be really careful about how I talk about, quote unquote, China. Because on the one hand, there is the People's Republic of China or the Chinese Communist Party that's running the joint that says all sorts of interesting things at the moment. And then there's the whole of China. There's the kind of the great multiplicity of China, the whole China being a sense of like having whole universes within it. And there's Chinese people, Chinese culture, Chinese language, the natural kind of affinities and curiosities we have about each other. Do you think under the surface, though, that there is still, after several decades of Asian engagement, there are still those person-to-person connections between Australia and China that work in contrast with the kind of overarching narrative, the nasty and vituperative arguments that are going on between our governments?
Absolutely. I mean, there's a few layers to this. I think one of the most depressing things about what's going on now is that very slowly these wonderful personal relationships are slowly becoming poisoned. So 5 years ago, if you were to take a taxi around Beijing, the Chinese people loved Australians. They absolutely loved us. They thought we were the best people sort of on earth. We loved the laugh. We loved the drink. They loved our nature. They were so envious about our lifestyle, our fresh environment, our wonderful produce. You know, they would express aspirations. You know, I'd love to live there. I'd love for my children to grow up there. There was so much goodwill. Sadly, over the last few years, that is just becoming poisoned by the politics, by the political rhetoric. And I think it's one of the saddest things, because this relationship, this goodwill, this trust has been built up over decades and decades of engagement, people-to-people engagement, on both sides. You know, Australians used to, you know, think well of China and the Chinese a number of years ago. So on both sides, sadly, that trust and that relationship's getting poisoned. And I'm really concerned that, you know, on the one hand, you can turn the political relationship back on, but to rebuild the people-to-people relationships might take a lot longer.
The CCP is not just quarrelling with Australia at the moment. There's also angry governmental statements being flung at Canada, the United States, Belgium, other nations all over the world. It's not just Australia. But why is the relationship with Australia so particularly nasty? Why has it gone so particularly badly to your mind?
I've been asking myself that same question, Richard. Why is it that we have been singled out for punishment? We know China's deeply unhappy with us being the first to call for an international inquiry into the origins of the coronavirus. We know that they were very unhappy with the foreign interference legislation and, you know, a raft of things that Australia has done. But it was Canada that arrested the daughter of the Huawei founder at the behest of the United States. It's been the UK and Canada and New Zealand that have labelled China's actions in Xinjiang as genocide. But yet they haven't been subject to $20 billion worth of trade strikes, and they haven't had high-level political contacts stuck in the deep freeze for the last few years. So why is Australia getting singled out? I think there's a number of sort of explanations for this. Some people say it's to make an example of us. Maybe there's some element of truth to that. But I think that there's something deeper and more irrationally emotional going on.
Really?
It reminds me of a relationship, a very close relationship, where you get expectations of gratitude. And then when that gratitude is not forthcoming, it results in resentment. I mean, it's a little bit like a domestic, a marital breakup, where one party will go, you know what, I've supported you financially for the last 30 years. Look at the wonderful lifestyle you have. Look at all the shiny things that you have. And you do this to me? You treat me like this? But on the other hand, the other party says, well, you know what? Yeah, you know, you supported me financially, but I've given you stuff as well. It hasn't been for free. It's not like I have not given you anything as well. So why should I need to be grateful to you?
And also there's this attitude that, you know, we might have been in a relationship all this time, but we can't but notice you've got someone called Xinjiang trapped in your basement that's crying out for help and is making all these noises. And we're going to raise that as a subject. And the Chinese leadership might not like that.
That's right. And it's an interesting analogy as well, because if you take a personal relationship, if you take a marital relationship, I think about my relationship with my wife. We don't live our lives in ideological extremes. You know, she feels that we should raise our kids in a more laissez-faire. They shouldn't need to study that hard, and they should enjoy their childhoods. I feel, being the, you know, the Chinese, the dragon father, I feel like they should spend more of their time studying and taking their education more seriously. Now, if we took that to ideological extremes, we'd be divorced years ago. But you don't do that. You are pragmatic, and you find a middle ground.
You grew up in sunny Bexley North in Sydney, not far from Sydney Airport. What are your memories of life in Bexley North as a kid?
Oh, I had a terrific childhood. It was a very Australian childhood. I'm a child of the 70s and the 80s. I grew up in this typical red brick house with a big backyard, and we had a Hills hoist and a big banana tree at the back. I had a next-door neighbour who was just 1 month older than me, and we did everything together. We used to catch lizards in the backyard and stick them in these Yagoa bottles and try to sell them to the workmen across the street. We used to ride our bikes up the road. There was a corner shop up the road, and we used to ride up there to buy lollies. You know, there used to be those lollies in the white wax sort of paper bags that you used to get for 5 cents, and we used to play Space Invaders, and we love playing cricket in the middle of the street with an old bat and those tin rubbish cans.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we used to have.
And if the ball gets caught by the dog in its mouth, then you're out. Yeah.
If you smashed a window, then you were a champion. And, you know, life in some ways, it seemed Australia was simpler sort of back then. I remember lunch was called dinner, and dinner was called tea, and they delivered milk in glass bottles with the foil caps. And we always used to go to the drive-in and in Dad's station wagon, and my sister and I, we'd be driving home at night and we'd throw a mattress in the back and we'd be fast asleep sprawled out in the back of Dad's station wagon. And that was growing up in the 70s.
Your parents are Hong Kong Chinese. Were they, you still maintain the Hong Kong or Chinese cultural practices in the home?
Oh, yes. So we're quite a traditional family in that way. My parents left Hong Kong in the late 50s. And so in many ways, they're a time capsule. Their particular version of Chinese culture or Hong Kong culture was the culture of the 1950s. So we did all the typical things, like we'd always take our shoes off, you know, at the front door. We would shower at night, not in the morning, because the thinking was, how could you go through a day and get all sweaty and gross and then hop into bed?
Yeah.
Of course, you shower before you get into bed. We always used to drink hot water and not cold because it would mess, you know, with your stomach. Dad would always be wrestling with friends at Chinese restaurants as to who would pay the bill. And my mother, who had experienced poverty, she would take thrift to its human extremes. And literally anything that wasn't bolted down in restaurants or motel rooms and even airplanes was pretty much fair game and likely to end up in her handbag.
So is it amazing that there are any salt and pepper sachets left in Australia? Is that amazing? Is it?
Well, there's at Mum's house, hidden away in one of her bathroom cabinets, you will find a plastic bag that literally will have about 3 or 4 kilograms of those little hand soaps from Air New Zealand in them.
One day it'll come in handy and you'll see. And then you won't laugh. Neither of us will laugh. She'll be the one with the soap. We'll be the ones going, I'm sorry you were right all this time. So despite all this ultra-burby Aussie childhood you had in Australia, how different did you feel at the time?
We were very different. And I didn't particularly like being different. I was a normal kid. I just wanted to fit in like everybody else. But I stuck out like a sore thumb. Mum would always pack extravagant lunches for me that consisted of soya sauce chicken drumsticks and rice, barbecued pork. And all I wanted was a ham sandwich.
Are you crazy? Really?
Like
really?
Everybody. Like
everyone
else.
Right. You wanted to put aside your delicious lunch to eat some yeast extract scraped across a bit of Wonder Bread.
Exactly. I just wanted to fit in. And in some ways it was impossible because we were physically different. And my English was poor when I first went to kindergarten because my parents, even though I was born in Australia, they spoke very little English to me at home. They always spoke Chinese to me at home. So when I went to kindergarten here, my English was poor. I had a very strong TH lisp. That only went away in high school, and I had to pick up my English through primary school. And I think, like a lot of other Chinese Australians, in some ways, we just wanted to fit in, and we weren't all that comfortable with our Chineseness because it made us different. And in some ways, I think we overcompensated for it. We wanted to be Australian, but the prevailing images of Australia at that time, and in many ways still today, are very different. You know, if you look at TV, if you look at Australian leadership, if you look at the sports heroes, the people in the media, our politicians.
Corporate leaders,
you don't see many people who look Asian. And for a young Asian kid looking and trying to find their place in the world and trying to find their sense of belonging, you kind of go, nobody looks like me. And the only people who look like me on television are the actors in like dim sim commercials and, you know, triad bosses, waiters and cooks. Those sorts of stereotypes.
How important was Bruce Lee to you growing up,
Jason? Oh, he was. My sister and I would record all the Bruce Lee movies on video cassettes, VHS cassettes, and we'd watch them over and over and over again. It was a huge part of our childhood.
He's the first cool Asian dude, as I recall.
No, absolutely. And in some ways, that is still the prevailing impression of the cool Chinese guy who's the kung fu master, the guy who can kick above his head and use the nunchuckers and stuff like that.
Other than that, it's Mr. Sulu from Star Trek and that guy from Hawaii 50. That's it, isn't it?
That's right.
As you walked around the family home, your grandmother's home, tell me about the photograph you saw on the wall of your great-grandfather.
Grandma was just the most amazing woman, and every night she would go through a ritual. there was a shrine with the ashes of my late grandfather, her husband. And next to that was a plate with a photograph, a black and white photograph of a very militaristic looking man with a shock of white hair and the full military regalia, who was her grandfather, the chief engineer of the Chinese Navy under the Empress Dowager during the First Sino-Japanese War.
Right, so we're talking about like more than 100 years ago then.
Yeah. Over 100 years ago. And Grandma would always, as part of this nightly ritual, she would kneel and pray in front of that shrine, and she would recite these Buddhist chants over and over again. And then she'd move a little bit to her right, where there was a Buddha, and she would chant in front of the Buddha for between 5 to 10 minutes. And then she'd move to another corner of the room where she had a Virgin Mary, and she would pray before the Virgin Mary because our family was Catholic. And so this was Grandma's nightly ritual, where she kind of had all bases covered
right
there. But on the plate was her father, Zhang Yuming, who he was the chief engineer in the Chinese Navy at the turn of the century.
The Imperial Chinese Navy.
The Imperial Chinese Navy. And he was knighted by King George V. He attended King George V's coronation in the UK, and we suspect the photo was taken there. So he had his medals on, and he was a formidable, stern-looking character. And he fought in the First Sino-Japanese War, where the Chinese Navy was just hopeless and no match for the Japanese. And his ship went down, and he survived floating on the open sea, clutching something for 3 nights by sucking on a piece of ginseng that he had in his pocket. This must have been him as a young sailor.
And how about your other great-grandfather?
My grandfather's father was also a knight. He was a very successful businessman in Hong Kong. He was also a knight, and there's a photograph of him as well in the long robes with his medals. And Mum has all sorts of old photographs of his wife, who had bound feet, tiny, tiny feet, which was the custom of the binding of the feet was the custom of the day. And they had all that going on until the war broke out, where they lost everything.
So the Japanese invaded Hong Kong. What stories did your grandmother tell you about that time? What happened to the family?
Pretty harrowing stories. My grandmother and granddad on Mum's side were in Guangzhou when it fell to the Japanese around 1938. And Grandma would tell us a story of my granddad, her husband. He'd been an overseas student in Japan early in the 1920s. And one day the Japanese army was marching towards their village in Guangdong province. And he plucked up the courage to seek out the Japanese commander. And with a bayonet at his throat, he spoke to the commander in broken but passable Japanese and described his experience being a student in Japan, spoke about how he respected the Japanese culture, how well he was treated, the terrific relationship he had with his host family, with whom he was still friends. And the commander was suitably moved and impressed and ordered his troops to spare this man and spare this village, and they marched on. But my father would tell us stories about when the Japanese occupied Hong Kong, and all the Chinese residents would need to bow to the Japanese of whatever age, including the children. If they weren't, they were dragged off to be sort of beaten up, and many tens of thousands were executed during that day. But it resulted in a deep anti-Japanese sentiment. I remember as a young boy, Mum used to sing me a nursery rhyme in Chinese. It goes, Yu Guang Guang, Jiu Tai Tong, Lin San Man, Jia Ban Long. And it goes on and on and on. It's a bunch of rhyming couplets until you get to the very end, where it goes something like, and then we bought a ship, and the ship sailed out to sea, and then the ship sank, and lots of nasty Japanese drowned. And then the kids would all go, way, hooray! And then I found out that nursery rhyme wasn't directed at the Japanese. It was actually, in its earlier version, directed at foreign devils.
Ah.
So it was directed at the foreigners in a much earlier era, around the turn of the century. We also got stories about Hong Kong and the history of Hong Kong and how it was lost to Great Britain as a product of the Opium Wars, which was really, if you reduce it to modern terms, it was as if somebody was importing crack cocaine into Australia, where literally a third of the population was addicted. And when our government tried to do something about it, they sent in the warships and kicked our butts and took Tasmania as compensation. Grandma would always talk about these things with a deep emotional resonance, a really deep sadness. It resonated with them because it reflected their own lives. China at that time was desperately poor, weak, bullied, and somehow they felt that in their own lives as migrants when they first migrated as refugees to New Zealand with absolutely nothing.
How did it resonate with you, though? You're hearing all these stories growing up in Bexley North in Sydney of a tumultuous century in China, which has gone from colonial exploitation to occupation to Japanese invasion to communist upheaval in the mainland and the war between the nationalists and the communists and the great expulsion from China and all that. Do you then, as a kid, on reflection, grow up thinking, oh, at least I'm safe here in Australia? Or do you grow up thinking that safety is really contingent? Like at any moment, there could be upheaval and crisis, and there's really no such thing as safety.
It was a completely different world. And I don't think I processed it all that much. You know, I didn't really understand it. This was a world of, you know, my parents and my grandparents, which probably had something to do with why I was so interested in going and living in China. When I did, I wanted to know where all this came from, because my experience was just so different in Australia, so different from all of that.
Podcast, broadcast, and online. You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler. You can subscribe to the Conversations podcast. To find out more, just head to abc.net.au/conversations.
Jason, your mum and dad migrated here from Hong Kong. How did they meet over there?
Dad's family lived on the third floor of an apartment building in Wan Chai, and Mum's family moved into the fourth floor when they were both about 5 or 6 years old. And Dad was smitten right from the start. And Dad was very studious. He was a bit of a nerd, good at maths and science, and he built a relationship with her by doing her homework for as these things go. But Mum's family decided to migrate to New Zealand. They had refugee visas. So Dad was just absolutely devastated. And I think it had a lot to do with why he decided to come to Australia himself. He had a choice. He could have gone to the UK, to Canada, or to Australia. He had offers from each. But he chose Australia. I think at least part of the reason was he knew that Mum was going to be within striking distance.
How did your mum's family get on in Auckland once they'd moved there?
They did it pretty tough. And they arrived, they were taken in by the Catholic Church. They lived with the priest in his home for about the first 6 months until my granddad got a job as an interpreter, running between the markets and the market gardeners, the Chinese farmers that would farm the vegetables. And until they saved enough money for them to move that, they lived with the Catholic priest. But my granddad was a great punter. He loved the races, and this was obviously frowned upon, and one day this was discovered, and the family was denied communion because of my granddad's gambling, and this was a tremendous shame. I think my family felt this great sense of shame and loss of face because of this, and it was at that time my granddad got the family together and vowed to them that never again would they be shamed like that again, and that the family would become wealthier and that they must stick together and be united, and only them would they be safe.
What was his plan to make the family wealthy?
So they started some of the first Chinese restaurants in Auckland. You know, they were sort of half Chinese. You know, they had the chop suey and the, you know, the old sort of 1950s, 60s Chinese meals, but they also had steak and eggs.
Chinese and Kiwi menu, was it like that?
Exactly. Yeah. So they started a restaurant called the Miramar on Wellesley Street, I think, in Auckland. And they ended up building up a stable of restaurants through the 70s and 80s. And that's where my sister and I spent a lot of our childhood, when we'd always used to go to New Zealand over Christmas. We'd spend about 2 months there every year.
And you were working in the restaurant?
I used to work in the restaurants.
From what age were you waitering there?
From the age of about sort of 15, probably not terribly legal, but I was behind the bar serving yumcha, making sort of fluffy ducks and the cocktails that were...
Brandy Alexander's.
That's right. The rusty nails. And we had a fabulous time. And so I have this time capsule memory of Auckland through the eyes of 1980s Chinese restaurants as a 16-year-old.
What do you remember of the chefs from the restaurant at that time?
Oh, they were the most eclectic bunch. I mean, these guys were fresh off the boat.
Yeah.
The practice was that you would sponsor, as a restaurant, you could sponsor the chefs, and you wanted to get the best chefs from Hong Kong or from mainland China, from Guangdong.
Well, that's all very well, but they'd be asked to come out and cook chop suey and steak and eggs, right, wouldn't they?
Well, at that time, at some of the later restaurants, the cooking was much more authentic. But these guys were fresh off the boat. They'd landed in Auckland. They generally came alone, and there was one night when a bunch of them, they went out in the middle of the night, went to the botanical gardens in Auckland with a whole bunch of sacks in order to catch the wild ducks clearly for roasting.
And did they get caught?
I don't think they got caught, but there was one time where they swore that they saw ghosts. My grandma saying there was a bunch of them. And they were in the domain in Auckland, and they swore, it wasn't just one of them, it was a group of them, swore they saw the ghosts of marching soldiers on a foggy night marching across the domain. It scared the living daylights out of them. So they would do things like that. There was one restaurant they had that faced Custom Street East, where the main door to the restaurant, on the left of the door, was the door to the kitchen. And it faced the street, and outside the door to the kitchen there was a bus stop with a bench. And after the lunch session, there was some free time before the dinner session started, so that the chefs would sit out on the bus stop bench and have grains of rice and feed the pigeons. Feeding the pigeons. And then when one of the pigeons would come close enough, they'd just snatch it straight into the kitchen.
Delicacy.
And then one day, I think an Auckland health official was taking the bus, saw this happen, and shut them down for a few weeks. But they were the most wonderful, colourful characters in the kitchen there.
You're a pretty driven student. You've got a law degree. How easy is it for you to relax? Is it hard for you to slack off and just take a couple of weeks off and walk around the house in tracky dacks and slippers all day? Or do you find that hard to do, Jase?
I can. I have this deep, ingrained work ethic in me that came from my mum. Mum was a primary school teacher, and as I said, she grew up in great poverty. And so when I was at primary school, Mum always extended us. We always did schoolwork that was at least 2 to 3 years ahead of what we were actually doing. That was the system. So Mum said, all right, well, you're in first grade now, so we'll just give you fourth grade stuff to do. Yeah. And so by the time you approached it at school, it was a piece of cake.
You took a position in The Hague, in the Netherlands, with the International Court of Justice. What were you doing there?
It was the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. I was the associate to a number of the judges, and in particular, I worked with Sir Ninian Stephen, who was the Australian judge at the time, and in particular with the Malaysian judge, Judge Vora. That was a fascinating sort of insight into the morals of armed warfare.
How has that affected your outlook and your values?
I was fascinated, for some reason, as a dark and brooding teenager, I guess, about the darkness of human beings. When I did my arts degree at Sydney Uni, I did my honours degree in German Holocaust poetry. And it really drew me into the human psychology around this dark sort of psychology, and it got me interested in genocide and in war crimes, and that was the area of law that fascinated me. It was my first sort of career, a big career interest.
How about the whole issue of individual human rights that the court upholds? Did that affect your thinking on that issue?
Very much so. And as you know, we're Australians. We grow up within the Australian value system, and having studied a lot of international human rights law, as I did in the Netherlands, and having worked at the war crimes sort of tribunal, we were imbued with the importance and the universality fundamental human rights. And, you know, I believe very much now, a lot of my friends will argue, well, there are circumstances where collective rights have to trump individual rights, where the benefit of the collective, of the community, has to come first. Look, I can understand how people may genuinely believe that until that day comes when they themselves or somebody that they really love become the victim of unjust power, official power.
In 1998, you came into the public eye. That's when I first became aware of your presence on the national stage. You got elected to the Constitutional Convention on the whole issue of whether Australia should become a republic or not. And you came out very firmly on the yes side, on the pro-republic side. What is that about for you, the republic? Is it about updating outdated symbols, or is it something else, something more than that?
It's about who we are as a people and who we are as a country. And the symbols and the institutions that define that, that was always what republicanism was to me. And the sense that in our modern society, where the Australian people come from everywhere, grounded in our Indigenous cultures, our immigrant history, magnificent diversity in our community, and yet our head of state is a member of the British Royal Family, it's just fundamentally at odds with who we are. And that's the basis for my republicanism. And taking it to the political realm, just the fundamental belief that the fountainhead of all power has to come from the Australian people and not from a particular foreign institution.
2005, you and your wife Lucy went to live in Beijing for 8 years, to live and work there. You had plenty of Hong Kong in you at that point. Did you have much of mainland China in you at that point? How familiar were you with the culture of old, deep Beijing China?
It was a culture shock. I had a bit of Mandarin, but it was poor. But it was an absolute culture shock. China is such a big, diverse place, and northern China is very, very different from southern China. It was much less developed back in 2005, so there was very little queuing. People would hoik all over the place. I think that was the thing that disturbed Lucy, my wife, the most. She has a great aversion to hoiking. People would, in the middle of, you know, reasonable middle-class restaurants, would blow their noses into their rice bowls. And truly charming things like this. But China was, of course, going through the most extraordinary period of development. A lot had very limited contact with foreigners back in 2005. This was a long time ago. And Lucy's Caucasian and our children are Eurasian. And so they were always a novelty. There would literally be crowds surrounding them, taking photographs of them. That was their brush with fame. I think they were like mini celebrities there. And Lucy always used to be mistaken for, she looks a bit like, I don't remember her name, but one of the Spice Girls, the blonde Spice Girl. Lucy had
Baby Spice. She
Baby
doesn't Spice. Like Baby
yeah,
Spice.
Everybody thought she was Baby Spice. Right. So whenever we'd go anywhere, she'd get mobbed. It was such a weird experience. On the one hand, I saw where everything from my family came from. What made us different here made us the same over there. Being surrounded by other Chinese people was profoundly different for me. So here in Australia, if I'm meeting somebody for the first time who hasn't seen me on the phone, I would generally say, I'm going to be wearing this and I'm Chinese. And that's how you recognise me. Whereas that didn't work in Beijing. That wouldn't get you very far. So it took some getting used to being a member of the majority, from an appearance perspective. But then I realised that people could tell as soon as they saw me that I wasn't local. It was something in the way that I looked, the way that I walked, the way that I spoke and carried myself. They knew I wasn't from there. They knew that I'd grown up from overseas. And I'd, in some ways, surrounded suddenly by Chineseness, I'd never felt more Australian. And I missed home a great deal. I missed all the great things about, you know, Australia, how you turn on the tap and fresh drinking water just comes pouring out and you can drink it without getting giardia. You know, I missed the wide open spaces and the vaulted blue sky and you realise just what a blessing that is and how it gives children, I think, in Australia a sense of freedom.
Before you left for China, all the public language is about Asian engagement, learning to speak languages, forming cross-cultural connections, all those things, reaching out, certainly making business connections. It was all good stuff. In the interim, Xi Jinping became presidents. China's gone from being an oligarchy to a dictatorship. It's become militarily and economically stronger, and all the language has changed. How is that affecting the lives of Chinese Australians in Australia, Jason?
It's been a really tough 2 to 3 years for Chinese Australians. I think it's been a tough couple of years for most people here and around the world, but it's been particularly tough for Chinese Australians.
Has there been a resurgence of public racism?
There has been a resurgence of public racism. I think it peaked about this time last year in 2020, when we were all wrestling each other in supermarket aisles for toilet paper. That was when the physical abuse of Chinese Australians sort of, I think, hit the peak. The China virus, all of that, you foisted this on the world. There was all of that. There was, of course, there's always been a little bit of discrimination and racism across Australia towards the Chinese. It's why Australia became a federated country in the first place.
First item of business of the federal parliament in 1901 was to pass the White Australia Policy to keep Asians out. Yes, that's right.
That's right. So there was that. And there's coronavirus, and then there was this great geopolitical tension between the United States and China, and all those things were a perfect storm and came together, which has resulted in a really challenging environment now for Chinese Aussies.
There was an upsurge in public racism and public violence against Asian Australians around 96, 97, when Pauline Hanson's One Nation appeared on the scene. Is it a similar thing, or is it different this time around?
Quite different. I think in 1997, 98, during the first rise of Pauline Hanson, the Chinese community actually mobilised. It was a different sort of racism. That was dumb, playground, adolescent sort of racism.
Ching Chong Chinaman.
Yeah, Ching Chong Chinaman. Yeah. You eat dogs and, you know, that sort of stuff. Now it's profoundly different. Now it's much more structural. It's much more subtle. It's tied back to very complicated geopolitics, where there is a nation, the People's Republic of China, that is being framed as an enemy to democracy, and where very powerful political and governmental institutions are engaged in the defence of Australian sovereignty against incursions in that sovereignty by the People's Republic. And so Chinese Australians were always going to be crunched in the middle of that.
Is this leading to alienation?
It's alienation, it's distrust. That's the scariest thing. The distrust, it's like a cancer. You can't see it. Racism, when you're abused on the street, at least you can see it, right? It's that you can video. It's in your face. What I think is even scarier is distrust, because you can't see it. It's invisible. But what it means is that there may be Chinese Aussies who were born here, like I was, or recent migrants who've been here for, you know, decades, but they don't get a job, or they don't get promoted, or they don't have, if they work for government. And it's really important that Chinese Australians can work for instance, the Department of Defence, or for DFAT, or for Department of Home Affairs. But they don't get their security clearances, because they might have relatives who still live in the People's Republic of China. And then people are concerned, well, what happens if we share national secrets, sensitive information? And then they come under pressure to divulge those secrets. Then they don't get their security clearances. This is just so damaging at multiple levels. It's damaging, obviously, for the Chinese Australians who don't have a career anymore and they feel distrusted. It's damaging for Australia's, I guess, defence of its own sovereignty, because what it does, as we've talked about earlier, it really plays into the charm offensive that the CCP is prosecuting at the moment, sort of saying, you know what, Australia doesn't really trust you. They'll never welcome you into their bosoms. You're not really one of them. You're actually one of us. So we've got to be really careful that we don't perpetrate that particular narrative. We don't support that narrative. But I think the most damaging thing is that it actually eats away at our own democratic values. So if we are standing up to the CCP, ostensibly to defend Australian values and our democracy, what does it say when there's about 5.5% of our population, 1.3 million Australian citizens, who are distrusted and we don't trust them? What does it say when people are afraid to speak up about stuff because they're afraid of being labelled a Communist Party spy, or they can't work for the government, or they can't work, they can't be shared information. You know, what does that say about our democratic values as a free and open multicultural society?
Well, this is the difficult line Australia has to tread. On the one hand, be firm in its defence of Australian sovereignty, Australian perceived values, the values we're supposed to be wanting to uphold, Australian interests, but at the same time, holding Chinese Australians in particular as closely as anyone else to the bosom of the nation, if that's the word. I mean, political leadership's got a role to play here.
Absolutely.
Doesn't it?
Absolutely. And I think, as a starting point, we have to trust our own citizens. That's got to be the starting point, because if you get into the business of distrusting your own citizens, that's what authoritarian regimes do. It's not what confident liberal democracies do. And my argument is that if we're genuinely concerned about the threat of authoritarian regimes to our democracy and our values, the best way we counter that is not to obsess overly with the authoritarian regimes, but to obsess a little bit more about ourselves and making ourselves better, making our democracy better, making our system of government better, and then being confident in that.
If Australia did want to mend some fences with China, assuming that Australia even wants to do that, or China even wants to do that at the moment, given that maybe both sides have decided they need to have a bit of a fight right now, if they wanted to do that, what are some of the ways where Australia could mend that fence without stepping backwards from our core values?
So at this point in time, if we were totally rational and if we lived in a fantasy world where there was no politics at all, what we would do is, as the vaccinations roll out and we thought about travel bubbles, amongst the first group of countries that we would have a travel bubble with, aside from New Zealand, should be the People's Republic of China. Because if you look at the infection rate and the amount of community transmission in China, it's very, very similar to what it is in Australia and New Zealand because of their, you know, draconian quarantine system. And so our Prime Minister, again in the fantasy world where there's no politics, in announcing these new travel bubbles, could say, we are opening our borders to this group of countries because their governments have managed the coronavirus well. Now, that would be so profoundly face-giving to the Chinese government that I think it would result in a rethink, some sort of olive branch. But importantly, it's not confected. It's not something made up. It's actually based on fact. And it's not capitulation to the CCP's economic intimidation, because it's just so profoundly in Australia's economic interests. If we open a travel bubble to China, Chinese tourists spend more and are more important to the Australian economy than the next five tourist sources combined. Chinese international students, again, are a larger source of income and benefit to the Australian economy than the next three or four student sources are combined. So this is absolutely in Australia's national interest to do something like this. Problem is, we don't live in a fantasy world where there's no politics, and it's very unlikely to happen.
You're talking at the highest level of societies here, where various political leaderships might have that conversation. But there's this other thing that's going on in Australia. It's been going on for quite some time, and that is Chinese-Australian intermarriage with all the other parts of Australia that produces all those shared sympathies, all those children, all those doting grandparents, all of those interfamilial relationships, all the cross-cultural contacts that are very deep. That's got to be a factor here, doesn't it, Jason?
I certainly hope so. And I certainly hope that we can get back to having those people-to-people relationships. This is the difficulty with the corona pandemic. Nobody's been able to travel. Everybody's been locked in here. And you know, this harks back to the comment I made earlier about, you know, we need to make ourselves better. Apart from, I think, North Korea, we're the only country that prevents its own citizens from leaving the country. China doesn't do that. So that's what I meant by, you know, if we want to defend our democracy, we need to work to make it better. Look, I think that there is a path back, and not that it should go back to the way it was. I don't think that's possible anymore. We've changed. China's changed. But it's really important that we do have a reasonable, productive relationship with China at multiple levels. It's important to our economy, and therefore it's important to our sovereignty. If our economy tanks, that's no good for our national sovereignty, sovereignty is not just about national security. The economic aspect of that is really important. It's really important for Chinese Australians, and it's really important for the world as well. There's only two ways to look at this. One school of thought is that we should just decouple from China, that we should have nothing to do with China. The Western world, liberal democracies, should just separate ourselves. The only thing that makes the world now different from the Cold War, where we were just a button push away from nuclear annihilation, is the degree of interconnectedness of our economies, of our people, of our societies now in this modern age. If we, through this call to decoupling, if we dismantle, you know, all of those scaffolds of relationships, then we really start going back to that very scary Cold War context.
It looks like we're going to be more of a partner in a global project or a much wider project to contain Chinese military power as part of the Quad, as part of Five Eyes, as part of a whole lot of defence arrangements that Australia is integral to. This is the likely outcome. What does that even mean if Australia is going to play a part in an effort that includes Japan, India, Vietnam, the United States, South Korea? What does that mean if we're part of that global alliance?
So a couple of things there. I think if we do it as part of an alliance, I think that is a better way to do it rather than us trying to lead this. I think it's particularly ironic that we decide to be a global leader in being tough on China, but not be a global leader on something where we have a whole lot of natural advantages like climate change and renewable energy. I think that's a profound sort of irony that can only be explained by those that know more about politics than I do. But I think that this, in many ways, is simply great power politics. It's what happens. What we should do is hopefully think about everything that we've discussed just now, Richard, and understand the particular emotional psychology and the history with which the Chinese people and the Chinese leadership come to these things. So having been invaded by Japan and suffered things such as the rape of Nanjing and all of that trauma, having seen its territory carved up by Russia, by Germany, by the United Kingdom, having suffered that sort of humiliation, what's going to be the emotional, psychological response when Australia announces that it's teamed up with Japan in a military alliance in respect of China? What does that evoke in the eyes of the Chinese leadership? China will always pursue its own interests. And where those interests are against Australian interests or our values, we have to push back against that. But I think that it would be a more productive exercise if we did our best to understand the particular historical and psychological context of the People's Republic of China when we do these things.
Great to speak with you, Jason. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Richard.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Hi, I'm Nazim Hussain. I'm a comedian, so naturally, I'm really good with money. I'm also the new host of The Pineapple Project, a new series of the podcast all about making life sweeter. This season, we're on a mission to make you rich. Well, richer. We're not going to tell you how to play the share market or start a multi-level marketing scheme selling you, I don't know, Nazim Hussain action figurines. Although if you do want one, there's only 499 left, so get in quick. I bought the first one. This is a podcast about saying no to all the stuff the world convinces us we need to buy to be happy, and helping you save a ton on things like phones, cars, eating out, and clothes. So join me for Frugal by The Pineapple Project. Get richer now and get it on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.